Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte. The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's WORKLAB, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey folks, as we've seen, a lot can change in 4 years when it comes to U.S.-China relations. Things have gotten so bad that the very foundations of global stability are now under threat. However, the U.S. is about to have an election, you may have heard of, which may drastically change the direction of things, for better or for worse. That is why on November 11th and 12th, SubChina is hosting our fourth annual Next China Conference online. This year, we are gathering together China specialists from all different fields to discuss what impact the elections will have on the next 4 years of U.S.-China relations. If you are connected to China, this is a conference you will not want to miss. The event is free for SubChina Access subscribers. Now that is a great reason to subscribe. Go to events.subchina.com to get your tickets and to learn more about our unbelievably great lineup of speakers. That's events.subchina.com. We hope to see you there. Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China, especially if you subscribe to our daily email newsletter, SubChina Access, and visit subchina.com to check out our wide range of reported pieces, op-eds, videos, and, of course, podcasts. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo. I'm coming to you today from my home in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Peter Hsiao, founder and CEO of Immortal Studios. Peter is a film producer. His credits include the 1998 film Restless, which I believe many of you have seen. It was shot entirely in Beijing, as well as one of the real bridge builders in U.S.-China relations, not just in film, but in many aspects of culture and business as well. He founded the nonprofit China Week, which puts on annual cultural events in Southern California. We were originally going to record this podcast live at China Week back in May, but the coronavirus, you know, upended that as it did so many other things. Peter is also the son of the late great Xiao Yi, who was one of the most beloved authors of wuxia xiaoshuo, or martial arts novels, that are devoured and enjoyed to this day by Chinese people the world over. Xiao Yi passed away in 2018, just 20 days after Sir Louis Cha, better known as Jin Yong, and it's in connection with his father's work and with the wuxia genre that I've asked Peter to join us today on Seneca, because when he told me about what he's got going, I was super excited, and just to have him on is just a great honor. Peter Hsiao, what an overdue visit to us, and welcome to Seneca.
Thank you, man. I still have a memory of you, Kaiser, wearing your fatigues at Cafe back in the day in Sanlitun. this is before the scene started.
That was the day, indeed.
You were in rock music, and I was in movies, and we were both Chinese Americans, and that's when the whole thing, before everything blew up.
Yeah, I remember that place well, Cafe on South Sanlitun.
It was like everybody who was working in the scene hung out at Cafe, and of course we've all moved on to do different things, and we're still here.
Yeah, we are, against all expectation to the contrary. Anyway, Peter, let's start as good filial Chinese sons must by talking about your father and his work and its impact on you. You told me that you started reading wuxia epics when you were barely able to read at like age 4, and you've never really stopped, right?
I haven't stopped. Look, it's the reason that I still read Chinese. I think it must have been Journey to the West or 三国演义, Romance of the Three Kingdoms, or I think it was probably 七侠五义. All my favorites, and that graduated me into real wuxia literature, which were his books, and of course Jin Yong's books and Gulong's books, and you know, these were also some of his contemporaries and friends. So other people were raised in political families or business families. Well, I was raised in a wuxia family, so that encompassed all my memories as a kid.
I would trade you. That sounds like a better way to grow up than in a political family like mine. That's fantastic. You have this nice, succinct definition of what wuxia actually means. It's on the Kickstarter page to the comic series, The Adept, which we'll talk about in a bit. You said, wuxia is a fantasy genre of romanticism and poeticism from the East. It is the realm of the outsider, the wandering hero who is compelled by circumstance to stand against injustice and champion the common person. That's just a great definition. Is there something that's distinctly Chinese about the xia that distinguishes him from a cowboy hero of like from Western, or like Cogburn and Labeef from True Grit, or so a questing knight from like a Sir Walter Scott novel, or, well, the Round Table?
There are several things. One is that I think you have, xia cannot be understood within the genre outside of kung fu. So obviously there's this tradition of superhuman strength and powers and capabilities from cultivating the self. There's a very well-defined transformative path in making one superhuman. So, and of course, because xia comes from the East, there's an element of being hidden, being more reserved, being less ostentatious, being less out there. So the xia that is really talked about within the genre is someone who is almost who's reticent, who's not doing it in the public square, who likes to do his or her deeds in private. Coupled with this transformative superhuman capabilities, and together they form this amazing mystique, and it's also impossible to talk about it without some of the philosophical ideals of the East. So that comes from, that's informed by Buddhism, Taoism, of course, Hinduistic ideals. So they really, really converge together in creating something very, very potent, enigmatic, evocative. That's very, very different from the superhero of the West who's flying around in the spandex, you know, has this name and does his or her deed standing, you know, atop a building, or bitten, frankly, by radioactive spiders.
So there's another word that's associated with wuxia fiction. It's a word that a lot of people have a lot of trouble defining. That's the word jianghu. How do you define the jianghu?
Jianghu is, you could call it kind of the realm that these kind of martial heroes often inhabit, but it's not exclusively so. So jianghu, I think, is associated with the people outside of the political or elites. It's where it's a different group of elites. So it's of smugglers. It could be tax collectors. It could be the people who are living everyday lives, albeit in a more pedestrian way, but also governed by a lot of the rules of that particular universe. In the martial universe, they're wuling, you know, the martial world, and jianghu are interlinked. And jianghu also comes to mind, certain clans and secret orders, the rules of that particular universe, the rules of that game. So jianghu is part of it. You know, it's a big part of it.
So
but
it's
the
like
jianghu
this,
does exist in China. It still exists.
Oh yeah, I mean, I know, like in the rock scene, they always refer to it as the jianghu.
Yeah,
and I'm sure that's the same thing for a lot of other scenes in China.
People still say it. I mean, you have people like Jack Ma. He still talks about the jianghu.
Yeah, the jianghu of the internet world.
Yeah. 人在江湖身不由己, you know, which is, you hear that quite often. You know, once you're part of this mix, you're forced to go with the flow, and you're subject to the rules.
Yep. So Peter, after your father's passing, you acquired his estate and rights to all of his works. And on that foundation, you have this amazing ambition. And that's what I really want to focus on today. And when you talked to me about it, you talked to me about, you know, creating an wuxia story verse that will, I hope to become to the wuxia genre what the Marvel comic universe has become to the whole superhero genre. So let's talk about your vision.
Sure. It's a pretty big vision. One is because I'm my father's son and I grew up reading this, so I've, as an adult capable of independent thoughts and living my life, I've come to a perspective on where I see the genre going or where it should go or where it originates from. So off of that understanding and, of course, then understanding of genre and how content works, I'm in the process of adapting his 60 pieces of IP into an interconnected universe. So the characters and the storylines now overlap. There's some continuity, and we decided to change the backdrop because one of my beefs with Wuxia, I love the ancient days, I love ancient China, but it gives you the feeling like those are the yesteryears. So some of, you know, that kind of magic, that kind of world is no longer visible today, which I think is a real shame, because I think today's conditions are as ripe as ever, if not more so, than it's ever been for that kind of storytelling to take place. So we're making a bold effort to bring all of that entire world to the modern day with an interconnected universe and characters. I've kind of basically broke down four subsections of Wuxia, because Wuxia is actually a big tent. Mm-hmm. Within Wuxia, you have more the realistic fighting, where kind of the mixed martial arts, or even Shaolin or Karate, or the various martial influences that we could actually practice. So Cobra Kai would also live there as well. So that's one distinct world where things are a little bit more productive. You can actually understand it. You think, oh, if I practice, I can get there. On top of that, but the second, you know, we have the Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, the hero universe, where it's more fantastical. People talk about Qingong, you know, the ability to take flight. These are a lot more surreal. These are more very evolved. And beyond that, you have the realm of the immortal swordsmen. These are almost semi-demigods. These are legendary figures. This is where also like Zhang Shangfeng or the Seven Immortals would live. Beyond it, you have Journey to the West. You have something really, really transcendent, intergalactic,
cosmological.
Yeah, so we're building a storyverse that brings in all four of those influences in an interconnected way. So that's never been done before, and to do it in a modern sense, where I think people who love the genre have the ability to suspend disbelief.
No, that's great. So four stages, or sort of four.
Four interconnected worlds with characters that would embody that. And then you overlap them and you lay it with a level of realism and believability, philosophical authenticity, practice and authenticity, and bring it all together. Because I think one of the complaints is that it seems like everything goes. You know, here's a lightning bolt. Here's a little bit of ass kicking. Here's a little bit of this. And somehow they all work together. So in as much as we have those elements, but we're going to lay it out, I think, in a more logical way, because there is there's a rational basis for putting it all together. So we're also doing that.
Right. So, I mean, let's face it, there have not been a lot of elements of Chinese culture that have successfully made their way into American life. Of course, there's food. That's been a wild global success.
Right.
The other exception is martial arts. I mean, I've heard you say before that you think that China's one great cultural export could be its wuxia genre. I think you said that, I'm going to quote you here, wuxia is the major Chinese contribution to global pop culture. It's the only thing that has persisted and that continues. Can you talk to me about why you think that is? And when you say it's persisted, I suppose you mean despite the Cultural Revolution and despite all the changes that have happened.
Well, some of those influences came on while China kind of went to sleep on itself during the Cultural Revolution. But because of folks in Hong Kong and Taiwan and the diaspora, those kind of legends continued. And of course, in no small part due to the 70s and 80s, the golden era of Hong Kong filmmaking, You know, this was this was popularized. But I think there's something global and universal about needing heroes. You know, really speaks to everybody. And this is true across culture because tyranny exists everywhere. You know, corruption exists everywhere. And in a more lawless environment, people rely on that kind of archetype. So there's a very, very deep and human need for heroes to inspire ourselves and to believe in the better angels. And then you have the differentiated factor of the of Eastern mysticism, you know, the ideals of perfection, the ideals of being superhuman, the ideals of cultivation. And all of that adds a very differentiated factor. And together, it's a very, very potent mix that speaks to, I think, again, a universal aspiration that seems like the Eastern canon can only fill.
Bring that, There have been some phenomenal exceptions. You talked about the Golden Age and Hong Kong filmmaking, for example. But still, I feel like rarely have Chinese martial arts epics been done right. I mean, done in the way that I want to see them done. I mean, there's good English translations now of some of Jin Yong's books. But in a way that just, I mean, remains true to what they are in a Chinese context, while at the same time being, you know, appealing for Western audiences outside of the niche of fanboys. Part of that has just been, I think, when talking about film, limited technology limitations in filmmaking know-how and limited budgets. But even now, I mean, all those things are basically solved, right? I mean, in China, they've got plenty of money and plenty of know-how, plenty of film technology.
And plenty of censorship.
Let's talk about that as a factor.
No, I think that's a serious factor that's limiting the progression of this dilemma, because if it has to serve political purposes and gone through that filter, it's pretty hard. And Kaiser, my position has always been, look, there's a lot of fans for martial arts films because it's easy. It's 90 minutes, it's 2 hours. I would argue, like recently I watched this. It's supposed to be a definitive documentary on Wuxia on Netflix. It did not mention Wuxia novels once.
Wow.
So to me, it's all in the literature. The literature inspired the movies, without which it would not be possible. So it's a far richer, complex, complete Wuxia experience comes from the literature, of which movies are only but an extraction from that source. So, and of course, beyond the novels themselves, beyond the literature, there's the living practices, there are the living legends, there are the actual folklore, there are the various traditions that are involved. So in creating the mortal, we're really tapping into the mother lode. So I am not deriving my interpretation of the genre from movies that were made in the 70s, because I think they're of a particular bent. And I actually have a problem with a lot of it, because to me, the violence, the senselessness, the vengeance, you know, they're but a fraction of the genre. And in a way, they're missing the mark of how these kind of stories evolved and where they came from. So we're we want to go back to the original influences.
No, that's fantastic. And the first step in this empire building is basically its graphic novels. I had the chance to read the first installment of The Adept. By the way, I was pronouncing it the adept, but I always saw that you said the adept as the
heard adjective. It both ways. I've heard it both ways.
Adept is like a person who is adept, right? But so the adept works too, but both ways, yeah. Anyway, we'll go with your pronunciation, the adept. It's this fantastic comic storytelling. I think it sets up a lot of mystery and develops these characters. I mean, in the space of a few pages, pretty deeply, pretty quickly. And there's lots of action, of course. It just looks fantastic. I really loved it. I gave it to my daughter to look at, and she really dug it too. She says, "Where's the next one?"
It's coming.
I'm not an expert on graphic novels or comics, but it looks like it could have quite a bit of appeal. Another one that I am really looking forward to is called The Chronicles of the Immortal Swordsman. Can you tell us what's going on with that?
Sure.
That looks great.
This is my favorite book growing up. So it really, that book inspired me greatly. I remember reading it as a 6-year-old kid, and just like looking at the sky, really like did what I was supposed to do. And I never forgot about that book. About 20 years ago, I actually had sold it to Lionsgate, and I had to buy it back because there's no way I was going to let someone mess it up, because they were just really struggling with it. So I got the Chronicles of the Immortal Swordsman back, and it's a story of the. It's a very classic story because my dad was one of the guys who actually kept the subgenre of Immortal Swordsman, also known as Shensha, genre going. Because there was this 60, 70 years where people stopped writing that, and he picked up the flag. So he's known as this is the story that kept the Shensha subgenre going from 100 years ago into modernity, and of course it spawned other things. It's a classic story of someone becoming an immortal. It used to take place in the ancient China's ancient mountains of ancient China, and you know there are various. Regimented aspects of the genre, how you find the teacher, because the teacher is supposed to come to you. You cannot find the teacher. There are certain rules with the subgenre. So we've actually changed the ancient China's, the mountains of ancient China for LA Chinatown. So that kid is now turned into a Chinese American kid growing up. And then so there's just a lot of really amazing modern elements added in while keeping the fantasy real and grounded with an introduction of technology. And after interviewing, working with so many writers over the past 8 years, I put myself in the writer's seat. So I've just completed the first two issues of the Chronicles of the Immortal Swordsman written, which I adapted personally.
Oh, wow. I can't wait to see it.
I put myself in the writer's seat. We're really excited about it.
And it's going to be a graphic novel
It's going to be a graphic novel. Well, it's going to start as comics, and then after we get three or four issues out together, they comprise a graphic novel.
So you're going for these modern settings, but you're also going to sort of delve back into history for the backstory and stuff like
Absolutely.
That, right?
Absolutely. Because, look, the authenticity of it is really, really important to us, because these are real traditions. I have a real problem with creators right now who just, you know, are just grabbing things out of thin air, as though there is no there to draw from. So we're going back to the authentic roots, because there are people who consider themselves on the path of being immortal swordsmen. I've met some of them. So it's a real thing.
I've met some people who think they're on the path of being immortal guitarist, but
probably pretty similar.
Oh my God, it's completely the same. I think, you know, there's such an overlap between heavy metal guys and wuxia fans. I mean, it's the same thing. It's just you substitute like musical chops for, you know, for kung fu skill, and it just maps perfectly.
I've actually done one of these trips, one of these hiking trips through Zhongnan Mountains and various ancient mountains in China. So some of these people do exist. And I've had the benefit of sitting down, talking to them. I've seen some of their stuff. Part of this writing is really an ode to a real tradition that continues to exist, and people pursuing a very just unprecedented, they have an unprecedented perspective. And I want to really honor that real tradition in our work as well.
So in a lot of ways, what you're doing is actually quite pioneering and actually progressive. I mean, in The Adept, you've put in Asian woman at the very center of the story. I mean, of course, I guess your father had done that 40 years ago when he published Sister Gan 19, and with Mulan and all that stuff, all the ideas of, you know, a heroine as the protagonist aren't entirely new, but still, it feels like if everything falls into place, I mean, we could see another kind of Black Panther moment, you know, when Chadwick Boseman, he died recently, of course. Yeah. So I've been thinking about what Black Panther did and the cultural impact for Black Americans. I mean, were you partially inspired by?
Absolutely, I was inspired. Look, growing up Chinese American, and actually growing up in Hollywood, I thought I had to go to China in order to make content that had people who look like me in central roles. Mm-hmm. So Black Panther, I think, really shattered that ceiling for everybody. So I think we've entered a very, very exciting and dynamic period, where finally America is really living up to its own strengths and its diverse strengths. It hasn't been proven beyond a shadow of a doubt, but by every indicator, people are ready for that. That's not to say you can't, you know, ultimately we have to tell very, very compelling stories. So properly representing Chinese wuxia to the world is something that we take incredibly seriously. But in addition to representing Chinese people and the Chinese experience, we're also expanding the genre to include everybody. So because we deal in so many stories, because we have so many different characters, for instance, I'm crafting African-American characters. I'm crafting all kinds of people to step into these wuxia stories, because the message is that everybody can be a hero, and we want to awaken the hero in everybody through wuxia. And that makes it very different and also very of this moment. And this is something, frankly, a Chinese-American can do that probably a Chinese creator could not do right now. So we're really thinking about, well, how do we take this, how do we continue this tradition now onto the world?
So are people who are familiar with your father's works going to be able to see this stuff and recognize the story as being...
Absolutely, absolutely.
Sort of like watching because, Clueless, you knew that was Emma or... That kind of thing.
Because I've now put myself in the role of being the editor-in-chief in addition to the head of the company. So I work very carefully with the original source material by my side, and I'm going through each line, each scene, each characters, and I tell all of our creators, if you can't make it better, then this stays. But if you make it better, then that changes. So. But look, my dad remains an amazing creator. I'm such in awe of what he does and in such a visual way. So people who like my dad's work, they're going to see an unadulterated version and a vision, of course, knowing some of his intentions and frankly knowing a lot of his limitations. Because this is how creators used to make their living back in the day. The guys who were actually working for a living, they wrote daily, and their works were syndicated by newspapers instantaneously. So I remember this visual of my dad laboring at his desk, writing on thick pads of paper with carbon in between. And the writing gets stuffed in an envelope, and the next day you see it syndicated on television. So there was no pre-planning. There was no editor saying, what about developing this character? You couldn't overthink it, because in order to make it go, that's how people made a living. And then the novels were compiled afterwards. So there is, and just now having worked in the creative industry for so many years, like, I'm surprised by how good it is without that kind of back and forth, that kind of development and planning and honing. So my dad never had a shot to properly hone his work. He just wrote in a stream of consciousness in a way, and then it went out, and then whatever became of them. So in a way, I have a chance to revisit and improve and develop and deepen some of the things that he's done. And of course, adding my own experiences to it. So it's almost, it's a dream come true. I can't believe I get to do it.
Yeah. Did he ever get a chance to work on any of the film or television serial adaptations of his stuff?
He has. He's written 20 movies, sometimes exclusively
For film. For
original concepts. So 20 of his screenplays have been made into films, and he's had he's had at least, I don't know, as many television shows. I remember when I was growing up, I've seen some of his movies in movie theaters and his television shows and visited a few sets. He gave that all up when he became an American at the height of his career.
And why did he move to the States? And that was like in the late 70s, right?
This was 77. He was the last to go. The entire Shao family had immigrated all over the world, and he was the last one remaining there. And I think there was
in Taiwan,
there was also concerns about, you know, in the 70s, Taiwan was still relatively unstable. I think you always felt like the other shoe was going to drop. So he decided to join his family, and I think he forewent the golden chapters of his own stardom to become an anonymous Chinese-American writer working in America while, you know, honing some of his classics, but people didn't know him here. And he somehow managed to have a continuity of the career by no management whatsoever. So it was really the sheer strength of his own writing. And then, of course, he was discovered by China in the 80s, and then had an amazing second chapter where he became one of the most celebrated wuxia writers in China, you know, when he was fairly active, thereby creating this, you know, Nanjing Beixiao, people in the people in the South Ri Jingyong, people in the North, Red Xiaoyi.
Red Xiaoyi. So tell me about that, Nanjing Bei Xiao. What is it about your father's work that appealed maybe more to Northerners than the Southerners?
Well, because we are, our ancestral home is from Shandong.
Yeah, from Heze, right?
From Heze. So it's the home of bandits. It's the home of, it's where.
It says that on the signs
It's where the Chinese boxers come from. They're crazy enough. It's also where the people from the water margin came from. So there's a very rugged, straightforward, authentic martial tradition. And so we pride ourselves on being Northerners, and we have that perspective. And I think it comes across that kind of rugged, individualistic thing. So in my dad's writing, you're more likely to have a Xia, whereas I think other writers have spent more time on the Jianghu, the intricacies of that kind of life. So there's a stylistic difference that comes
interesting.
Across.
Yeah, that's it reminds me of this interview that we did with this guy named Thomas Talhelm, who had written this interesting study of Northerners and Southerners based on rice cultivation in the South versus wheat cultivation in the North, and the different sort of sociological impact of those, because you need so much more sort of community effort to grow rice. It requires, you know, really coordinated planting all at the same time, or the transplanting of seedlings, and a lot of irrigation. Whereas the North, with rainfall agriculture, you know, individual farmers, individual families can cultivate a field. And his conclusion was that there, and did a whole bunch of other sort of psychological experiments to parallel this, that in fact Northerners do tend to be more individualistic. That's interesting.
I've had a chance to visit Heze, and just had the chance of a lifetime to go back with my dad, actually. So, you know, I'm still burning up on my own Heze bona fides, but I've gone back to my ancestral home. And, you know, it's impossible to talk about this without talking about my own grandfather, because I think there is a generational thing, whereas my grandfather was known as the war god of that entire region by having participated in the defense of China against the Japanese invasion. So I think there was a big part of that martial tradition that passed over from my grandfather by virtue of coming from Heze onto my dad, and somehow it made its way to me. You know, I think there was a moment in time when I spent a lot of time with my dad, so in as much as it's really sad to see him go, by the time we said goodbye, I felt like the handoff was complete. You know, there's that recognition that what was very much alive and passion in his spirit somehow was awakened in me. You know, it's kind of esoteric. I can't really describe it, but there's this one day I woke up and I said, whatever my dad wanted to give to me, I got it. I know I have it. And so it's still with me today, and I rely on that voice to guide me through this iteration. So in so many ways, it's a very Chinese story.
Peter, so tell me about Immortal Studios itself, about some of the folks that you've attracted to you, because, you know, you're putting together a little bandit army all
yourself. We call it kind of the A-Team. I'm really glad that the editor-in-chief of Marvel during one of their golden eras, Carl Potts, has joined our team. So I work very closely with Carl. We have all kinds of ideas, because I think there's a lot of stuff that Marvel has learned in birthing their universe that we want to stand on their shoulders. We have very talented product managers. So I think of this business not just as a creative enterprise. I think we're 1,000% creative, passionate, and we believe in the stories, but to build a really powerful 21st century content studio, you know, with the backbone of technology, and looking at the entertainment industry in a very evolved way, because there are some fundamental shifts. So we are building a direct-to-consumer business that's really around the fan experience and engagement, where social media and transmedia applications, audience engagement, user-generated content, all of those things are a part of the mix. So it's a yin-yang mix. So our business game is very, very tight. And we've got a core group of 10 very talented people from social, from product to technology to strategy. And each of them having achieved a level of mastery in all the their respective fields. So really putting that team together, and we're just getting started.
And all of them buy into the sort of essentially Chinese core elements to this, right? And they all,
yeah, I mean,
they,
look,
they get it.
Our motto is to awaken the hero in everybody. Obviously, everybody, not just to the Chinese. There's a recognition, there's a respect that it comes from China. But there's also a recognition that we are stepping outside of racial boundaries while paying homage and proper respect to the origins. And there is this balancing, but ultimately our goal is to take it, the message all over the world. So, and I think we all believe Wuxia is the perfect vehicle for that.
So the plan is to begin with comics, with graphic novels, and then assuming that that catches fire, to partner up maybe with a big studio, maybe a Sony Pictures, and then turn one of these into a major film franchise, something for the big screen or for HBO or something like that.
Yeah, well, we're never going to back away from the comic world. I'm now a lover of this art form, and it's going to be an evergreen part of our business. And it's a really amazing art form. It works very quickly, and it's also COVID disruption proof. So for a variety of reasons, we love this comic form. There are very good fans who are committed to this. So we're going to continue to publish on a pretty good cadence, and that business never goes away. And the vision is not to be subsumed under a studio. You know, frankly, we've had those opportunities already, but to build our own fan base and a data-oriented business so that we could openly compete with everybody. Because the name of the game is really, if you have a fan base that's connected to you, we don't need to be intermediated by third parties, including studios. I'm happy to partner with them, but it's not going to be the kind of exploitation relationship that we've seen in the past. So we're prepared to stand our own 2 feet. And this is where, having been a film entrepreneur, media entrepreneur, there's no mystery in how films are packaged and sold or financed. So we have, frankly, a lot of those capabilities even on our own board today.
You think there's interest from the Chinese side in funding something like this? Have you had interest from, say,
To tell you the truth, we were very adamant about creating an American company right now that belongs to the world. And we want to succeed in the English language world first before, and then consider how we're going to grow in China.
Okay. So yeah, that makes sense. Because I can imagine like a company like Tencent just seeing the video game possibilities and seeing the...
We've had discussions before this moment of acquiring my father's library and doing a variety of things with the BATs of the world. So we welcome the opportunity to work with them, but ultimately it's going to be on our terms and not anybody else's. So we're fiercely independent that way.
At one point you were managing, I think at least for North America, the brand Shaolin, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. How was that? What was that experience like? Because I know there's always been a lot of controversy around it in China.
Right. But look, I consider the abbot a friend, and I've spent enough time with them, both on stages and in person, to form a personal opinion about him. But ultimately, Shaolin is the repository of much of the mythology of Kung Fu, and being invited and given the keys to go behind the outer shells into the inner sanctum and to see an amazing heritage that's very much alive was an honor of a lifetime. So having, I really got to geek out by learning from a lot of the masters who continue this lineage. And the authenticity, to see where it all comes from and to know that there is a lot of there and a lot of reality. And then so that further gave me the confidence to extrapolate those ideas and now to bring it hopefully in an authentic way. And we talked about our first book, The Adept. So one of our goals is to bring, because The Adept, the Amy, the lead character, actually learns from a Shaolin master. So I'm very much involved in working with the writers to make sure that a lot of my authentic Shaolin experiences get funneled in that way as well.
That's just wonderful. Yeah, and the depth is great. I can't wait for the next installment. When is it, you think?
Look, we're going to be in production on our second and third book before the year's over. So stay tuned.
Okay.
Stay tuned. Great. We're making some adjustments, and the Adept, I'll just say it here, is going to really address a lot of things that people are talking about, including who can kick better ass, you know, traditional kung fu or mixed martial arts. So we have a lot to say about, you know, various trending topics from this kind of immortal perspective.
All right. Looking forward to it. Peter, thanks so much for taking the time. What a pleasure it's been talking to you. Let's move on now to recommendations. But first, a quick reminder that the best way to support the work that we're doing with Seneca and all the network shows is to subscribe to our SubChina Access newsletter. If you aren't already subscribing, please do. It's truly amazing. You'll find it is money very well spent. Okay, Peter, recommendations. I'm going to give you a license to completely self-promote on your stuff here, because it's great.
Look, for people who are interested in what we're doing, I'd like to invite you to visit our website, which is immortal-studios.com. As you're listening to this, we're experimenting with a version of crowdfunding that we've never done before, which is an equity raise. So we're inviting people who like our vision, who want to see this kind of martial universe, to participate in our WeFunder campaign. So you can just go to WeFunder.com and look up Immortal Studios. So thanks for letting me pitch you guys.
Hey, thanks. Okay, so for my recommendation, I mentioned Sir Walter Scott at the top of the hour, thinking about Western parallels to Wuxia. And that may have been subliminally suggested to me by the fact that not long ago I watched the 1997 series. It's a 6-episode series by the BBC of Ivanhoe. And if for no other reason, you should watch it because the late Christopher Lee plays the head of the Knights Templar in that. And he's just fantastically evil. And it's great. Anyway, I think on this show, I've probably recommended before re-watching the 1983 or whatever version. It was from the early 1980s. That television version of Ivanhoe. This BBC one from 97 is just, it isn't as campy, but it's quite well done, and it gets to tell the entire story out over, you know, the full nearly 6 hours. Highly recommended. Anyway, thanks once again. That's what a great conversation, and I can't wait to see you. Make sure you send me some of that stuff on it. I'll share it just really closely, but only with my daughter.
You got it.
Who's already a fan.
I'll send it to you on the QT.
All right. Thanks so much, man. Great to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and make sure to check out all the other shows in the Seneca Network. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.